cultural, and community hubs across the Lower Mainland. To find out how you can be featured in Discorder Magazine, contact advertising@citr.ca, advertising@citr.ca. Rates start at $150. Ride with Discorder Magazine and we'll take you all the way.
What's been difficult for me personally as an artist, in quotation marks, has been the push or the desire on the part of colonial structures for myself as an Indigenous person to create works that fit within the colonial structure of objectification and commodification of Indigenous expression.
That was artist and activist Marianne Nicholson, and this is Medium Good. Hello and welcome to Medium Good. This is a limited series by CITR 101.9 FM about messages of resistance and the art mediums we use to manifest them. My name is Serena, I'm your host, and I'm also a sociology student at the University of British Columbia, which is where CITR station is located. This series is a hybrid between spoken parts by yours truly, as well as interviews with many people involved in the world of advocacy and the world of art. This is a topic that is very near and dear to my heart, and I'm going to try to represent the stories and the efforts of the people I'm talking about here today as best as I can. This is not a comprehensive series. This does not include everyone that works within these realms, all of the work that they do, or all of the themes that could be talked about. So please, if any of this is of interest to you, I strongly encourage you to do your own research, to talk to your friends and your professors, your classmates, your coworkers, your family about these topics. There are also lots of other programmers at CITR that do really, really great work with these topics, especially for today's theme of indigeneity and institutionalization. CITR's Indigenous Collective does some really great work with that, so please be sure to check out some of their episodes. And with that said, I want to take a moment to acknowledge that CITR, which is located on the University of British Columbia Vancouver campus, is on unceded and stolen Musqueam territory. Indigenous voices in so-called Canada have been systematically devalued and diminished, and this cannot go unacknowledged in broadcast media such as radio. CITR, as a media organization, has to grapple with its standing as an institution and as an institutional affect that falls under UBC's historic and continued settler colonization. This colonial thinking permeates and extends to the very edges of our society and our social organization. Good decolonizing work has been done, but there is still very far to go. Take these land acknowledgements, for example. They often fall flat and are called disingenuous or insincere by Indigenous activists and allies alike. They have been critiqued as a half measure or a facade, something to make the institution seem anti-oppressive or more approachable, but in reality is not carried nearly far enough to impact any actual change. Don't get me wrong, I am in no way saying that land acknowledgements are not helpful or useful for bringing to front of mind the ongoing land theft, cultural assimilation, and genocide of Indigenous peoples in Canada. What I am saying is that it's effectively a band-aid on a bullet wound, and counterintuitive to expect an inherently oppressive institution to engage in deep, meaningful, and effective anti-oppressive work. But there are ways to get the institution to serve your needs and transmute some of its power to work for something good. Let's hear from artist and activist Marianne Nicholson, who we heard from a little bit already, with her work in art and advocacy in the institutional space of the art gallery.
My English name is Marianne Nicholson. My Kwakwala name is Haichant Hayalakilach. I'm Muskamak Dawadenoch of the Kwakwakiwak, and I'm an artist, and I would consider myself a political advocate for Indigenous rights. So this is the second part of a two-part engagement with the Belkin. The first one started off with an exhibition that was called Hech Sa'am, which really brought together Indigenous political advocacy within an art, what's considered to be an art space, and it really started to kind of blur those edges. And then this is the second part, which is really, again, challenging what we consider to be art. So this piece, especially because it's leaning more towards the ephemeral, and part of the strategy around that is that I would say, if we're going to use some big words, that neoliberal capitalism has fostered an environment that really objectifies art, and this is an attempt to kind of push away from that objectification and into more ephemeral forms, such as audio and radio. And what's interesting about it as well is that we're also playing with these definitions that the contemporary cannot be traditional, or that Indigenous advocacy can't come through contemporary means, to say, in fact, that much of our political advocacy has been in through processes of appropriation of colonial introductions and methods, etc. Where my own inspiration comes from is having experienced two very different platforms or for what people consider to be art. And part of that is, say, amongst the Muskmak Dawadenoch, what we would consider to be our art practices are far more fluid than how art has been somehow partitioned off within a colonial context. So in my own practice, I have a traditional practice which remains within community and within our, I guess, ceremonial type structures. And then I have a contemporary arts practice. But what I've been doing over the last several years is really blending those, or the boundaries, really challenging what those boundaries are. And so collaboratively, especially with the Belkin has put forward the opportunity to really challenge those boundaries and redefine what we consider to be art, how we navigate spaces that are dedicated to art, and how do we bring in other alternative interpretations. Part of what the attempt is here is to look at more collective experiences. I would say that the trajectory of a Western art practice has been very much individualistic, and it fails to recognize that much of our experience and then how we translate that as individuals actually comes from collective experiences. So this is part of the shift, a very intangible, very, very sometimes difficult to pinpoint shift, to say that when it comes to particularly Indigenous expressions, those Indigenous expressions are collective, and they come very strongly out of a collective visual practice, but also a collective experience, socially and politically. What's been difficult for me personally as an artist, in quotation marks, has been the push or the desire on the part of colonial structures for myself as an Indigenous person to create works that fit within the colonial structure of objectification and commodification of Indigenous expression. So it's very interesting for me, and I'm really grateful for the opportunity to enter into a space and to start dismantling those notions, and to start to consider and experiment less individualized expression and more of a collective experience. This is an example, like the radio broadcasts through radio are meant to be collectively experienced by a group, whereas today through the modern media, much of our engagements through algorithms are actually quite isolating, because they're targeting your specific likes and searches to curate a particular experience, which is actually very isolating, and we end up losing that collective sense that other people are experiencing having similar experiences to what we're experiencing, or at least considering perspectives from a more collective base. So I have real concerns about that for our Indigenous youth coming up, because this is one of the reasons why it's so emphasized in this exhibit, is a voice from the past to say, look how anchored we are to the past. Look at what our grandparents and our great-grandparents and our own parents were doing from generation to generation to generation. And the messaging was consistent all the way through that to today, and how important and valuable that is for us to know, so that we know what we do today has that strong foundation of prior advocacy. But what has been happening is that history is being eroded. The understanding of that history and that foundation is being eroded. So this is really literally the attempt to re-vocalize those messages from the past into a contemporary experience.
I want to take a moment here and talk about Gregory Cholette, who is an artist, writer, educator, and activist who works within the art world. His book, The Art of Activism and the Activism of Art, tackles the idea of putting different modes of expression into different categories and thereby ranking them in our social order. I find his work very, very compelling, and reading his words is actually one of the reasons that I was inspired to make this project, so I'm only going to be taking a couple excerpts out of his work, but if anything we're talking about in this series interests you at all, I highly recommend that you check him out. He's a lot more of an expert on this matter than I am. To use his words on why he's interested on the subject, quote, "We are witnessing today a surge of artistic activism unlike anything seen since the 1960s and 1970s. Recent museum interventions, exhibition boycotts, picket lines, occupations, mocking memetic websites, and staff unionization campaigns target unfair labor practices, institutional racism, colonial collections, and financial ties between museum board members and weapons manufacturers, fossil fuel extractors, opioid producers, and real estate speculators. Just as emphatic is the surge of artistic activism taking place outside the art world's institutional boundaries, including performative street protests employing stencils, banners, graphics, puppets, protest pageantry, and makeshift counter-memorials in city streets. On one level, activist art is a singular facet of the broader, accelerating field of socially engaged, collective, and participatory art, a cultural phenomenon that also goes by such names as new genre, participatory, relational, dialogical aesthetics, and social practice art. In little over a decade, all these modes have moved from the margins of the art world to a more central visibility. With this shift comes growing scrutiny and interest from younger artists, critics, theorists, historians, and teachers, but also from NGOs, foundations, and governmental policymakers, as well as a few commercial galleries and collectors. In this introductory quote, he's still using a rigid boundary between art made for the sake of activism, such as graphics and posters, and art that has activism encoded into it that would be then hung in a gallery space. But he does ask further on in the chapter if that line still exists. To him, the idea of that line disappearing has massive implications. Essentially, he says that art has long dreamt of having historical agency, and artists seeing themselves as key socio-political players. But that may have switched hands now, with activists wanting to have their own, quote, aesthetic incarnation. We're going to continue to think on this for the rest of the episode, but I want to just acknowledge that when Gregory Cholette is talking about art and the art world, he's really talking about the art world in the institutional sense of art sales, art collections, and the massive public and private institutions that we know as museums and art galleries. One central tenet of these institutions is in the tangibility of art. It has to be something that can be bought, sold, collected, and exhibited, or else it's not of any value to the art world. Sure, this idea has been flirted with a little bit with NFTs, but I argue that NFTs haven't completely invaded the actual art world or the art institution like they've invaded the pockets of the billionaires that tend to also collect art. So what does it mean to make art that can't be commodified in the same way as a sculpture or a painting? Marianne Nicholson calls it pushing the boundaries. This is because, as the tangibility of art is directly connected to its commodification, that commodification is connected to the colonial capitalism that dictates what we see as fine art. Sound art, on the other hand, an inherently intangible form of artistic expression, according to the Avant Art website, is a form of artistic expression where sound serves as the central medium and material. It's more of an oral experience than visual art, but visual elements can coexist with sound. This is precisely the case with Marianne Nicholson's recent exhibition, but as you'll hear in the next clip, that exhibition stems from the creation of a community radio station in her hometown. So I want to take a moment to talk about radio art, which is a different way of using the medium that I'm using right now. Radio art is an umbrella term, and essentially anything that isn't, well, this, can fall under it. It's an appreciation of the space of radio that doesn't have to fit the matter-of-fact way it's typically used. It's a form of art that's specifically composed for the medium of radio, and it's uniquely suited to be transmitted via airwaves. In my opinion, this alternative use of radio ties right back into pirate radio, which is the unlicensed radio broadcast intended for general public reception. Pirate radio stations have popped up all over history in all sorts of different places and time periods for different reasons, with many of them being elaborate professional undertakings that skirted government regulation by transmitting from outside the national boundaries of the signal's target audience. Pirate radio is clearly a way that people for generations have turned an institutional power into something they used to transmit messages of resistance. Radio broadcasts reach over 90% of the world's population, but it's a mode of communication that's falling more and more out of use. Let's appreciate radio for what it is and take it back. Go radio!
This all came out of creating a community radio within our own community, and also having talked to a lot of older people who were engaged in land advocacy from the past, and how radio, newspaper, all these forms were really being utilized at the grassroots level to mobilize political action. So the radio, we started up a radio station at home in Kinkoom Inlet. It's called CKYO Radio 91.1 FM. And the purpose of the radio really is community connection. It's to help community members to be able to feel that there is a communal space. And I suppose that space is conceptual in ways, like it's an audio space. But if you know that there in each home is a radio, that there's a broadcast that's happening that is particular to your community, and that there is an expression there that is trying to reflect the needs and the histories and the aspirations of that community, then that helps build collectivity. And I'm finding today, particularly when it comes to Indigenous advocacy, that our struggle to maintain our collective conception of ourselves and our collective ties to one another is absolutely integral to our healing from the intergenerational trauma that we've inherited through the colonial processes. So community radio is one tool that we're utilizing to kind of move forward with healing and rebuilding of those connective tissues that were kind of, I wouldn't say destroyed, but they were certainly kind of rendered weaker through, like, the residential schools and the potlatch ban, and also the epidemics that really, you know, just really decimated our populations, and those all came with colonization. This is a pushback against all those processes. It's very small, but it seems to be coming from the root of the problem and attempting to address the root of the problem.
And there's also with radio that accessibility element as well. It's on a technological standpoint, radio is broadcasted to 95% of the worldwide population, as opposed to, I think, 56% of people around the world access to, like, internet. So things like podcasts and stuff like that becoming a more used kind of form of, like, spoken literacy is actually, like, a step away from the accessibility and that, like, access to organizing and grassroots movement. And I don't think it's wholly coincidental either that this push towards the internet that is, you know, governed by forces that are maybe not as clear as dismantling physically a radio station. I think it's really important to go back to those slightly older forms of technology, slightly more. I know you called the exhibition intangible at one point, but I also think that radio, or making radio in itself, is to some extent a tangible practice as well, that I think that we don't necessarily get by using our computers for certain things. But yeah, if you wanted to speak to the accessibility.
Yeah, it's funny because the word that was coming to mind at times is low tech, like trying to do grassroots work, trying to use more low tech because it's more accessible. Certainly, like, there's no opposition to utilizing web-based and the higher technologies for the work that we're doing. But in terms of access, radio, even, like, newsletters, newspapers, these things that are kind of, they are almost, in a way, getting shuffled out by the high tech. But then there comes the problems of who owns high tech, who controls high tech, whereas radio can be owned by at the community level, same with newspapers and newsletters, that type of messaging. So this work also, it's very interesting because this has a parallel in how it pushes back against notions of high art and how art spaces have for a long time been considered spaces of, I guess you might consider them high expression. But there's an hierarchy there that we're trying to dismantle, to say that there is just as much validation in these grassroots expressions. And so it's a very, very intriguing intervention within what is often considered to be high art, or the impression that art has a certain caliber or look to it. So we're challenging all of that on a number of levels. And the other aspect of that I think is really important is that the contested spaces for Indigenous peoples, in order to occupy spaces, we want to be able to occupy them on our own terms, not create high art for high art spaces. We want to transform high art spaces into more accessible spaces for all types of art practices, including ours. So that's one point that I would like to make, and deeply appreciative of the Belkin Gallery for being open to those ideas. And actually, in my opinion, these ideas need to infiltrate from this level all the way up to the National Gallery level, because that's the messaging down at those levels, what's messaged down to people in terms of access to space, transformation of space, and transformation of how we think about those spaces. To me, it's a metaphor for the country in itself. It's not just contesting space within the gallery. This is a space where we can experiment with those boundaries, But we're really talking about the contestation of space within the country itself. And that comes down to Indigenous land rights. And that's why it's so important to have this reflection on those rights and this history within this space to challenge on all these multiple levels what has happened in this country.
Mm-hmm. Just going off of one of the things you said there, I often hear this idea that, like, sure, art isn't apolitical, but the art world is apolitical. And even if it's not said, it's kind of underscored in certain ways. And I think that that's obviously not true. And especially this question of, like, whose land are we on, and how do we even have such a thing as the National Gallery of Canada that we can, you know, exhibit a very select few of Indigenous artworks in. It's like that idea of art as transcendent comes from the idea of trying to keep art not political, and that if you make it to be something that is accessible for people and it is political and it is coming from communities and for those communities, then it's, like, you know, not seen as high art, as you're saying. So yeah, if you want to leave us off on any last notes about your work in general, or this piece, or your advocacy work as well.
I would say this type of work is also challenging for me personally, to push my own boundaries as an artist. What is art? What is art practice? My art practice has really shifted, I'd say, in the last 10 to 15 years. You know, what I would consider to be production or productivity, much of my productivity is not tangible in the way that it used to be, like in terms of creating an art object. But it's really hard because I'm really crossing the boundaries. I'm really pushing against the boundaries. And for me, this is just as much and just as valid as having created a physical artwork. It's more about visioning and voice. And actually, in a way, what I've tried to do in my practice is open up spaces for a more collective vision and voice to come through, whereas in the past there was a real emphasis on what product or art product I was creating. You know, that was what was kind of fostered and encouraged from my art school experience through to today in terms of the outside world. But where the influence came from to try and push at these boundaries was my community-based traditional practice, which is so much more about collective creativity and connection. So that's where I'm really drawing from. And I also want to say that what happens then as well is that in working with the institutions, then the institution also becomes a partner in that, and it becomes more of a collective process as well.
I think that idea of the institution becoming a partner in anti-oppressive work or in advocacy work is something that has been really hard for me to grapple with as I'm doing this project. And I totally understand and agree with Marianne's point about infiltrating the institution from a certain level so that you can move up into higher levels and transform those spaces to something that's accessible and something that's helpful. But I think that there's also such a romantic idea about full system upheaval that I do believe ultimately is the only way to have a complete change, is to have a complete system renewal. But also in the meantime, we have to make things better, right? And to me, that's the core essence of harm reduction. And we're going to be talking about harm reduction in our final episode. But until then, I will say that I think there are a lot of people that are doing a lot of good work to lessen the damage that these institutional structures are having on any kind of person that's in a minority population. And one thing that I hear from a lot of these people doing this work in all sorts of different ways, in all sorts of different avenues, is to take guidance from the community and not from the institution. This means talking to people, this means reading books, this means going back to old forms of knowledge and not taking everything at face value. This means not listening necessarily to the news or to the dominant media, but instead going out to find your own answers and develop your own understandings and your own empathies. And that's something that I'm really trying to bring into this project, is just listening to the community members that I have around me. And that's why a lot of this project is so interview-based. So with that said, I want to turn to another person doing really good work. The next interview is going to be from Karen Duffick from the Museum of Anthropology at UBC. She's the curator of contemporary visual arts and Pacific Northwest at the MOA. And in this interview, I'm talking to her a little bit about her new exhibition, To Be Seen, To Be Heard, which is on view right now.
All museums are, you know, finding ways of, you know, responding to, but also facing up to and making public their own role within histories of colonialism, because we're part of that history. And so to be able to use that, like not just think about behind the scenes, but to make that kind of dealing with a visible part of exhibitions and public programs is really important, because the public as well is quite eager to learn about always like what's happening behind the scenes, what's happening in terms of museums working with Indigenous people and grappling with big issues that aren't in any way resolved, but that we have to work out together. And to show something of that process and to include Indigenous voice always in these, whatever it is, an exhibition or public program or some sort of audio piece or something, is absolutely essential, you know, to show there's a conversation happening, there's a dialogue, and it's shaping museums.
And it's a bit more of an active way to portray these things as well. And I noticed that there's also the like spoken word map project also in the Great Hall. And I think that that's really great, especially with like such a tradition of oral history, to like when you are in charge of representing that history and like a different people's history, that you're incorporating not only like the actual facts that, you know, are relevant, but also maybe like the ways that things are told.
It's all these different stories essentially, right, that people have that need to be told in different ways. I know that the Tahltan artist Peter Morin, we have an installation of his in our multiversity galleries called This Song is a Museum. And he said what's often missing from museums is the song. And that simple statement, it kind of, you know, that museums by their nature are accumulations of things, right? Physical things, whether it's an anthropology museum or a history or a natural history museum. And so it's the biggest challenge is always to show the connection of that thing to something outside the walls of the museum. Mm-hmm. And I think in this particular exhibit, To Be Seen, To Be Heard, it's the history, it's the acknowledgement, I guess, in terms of the belongings and objects that are in this show, that they have a political and social history that is often not told. It's not the standard narrative of, for example, Northwest Coast art. We look at a button blanket, we look at a Chilkat robe, and we can admire the technical aspects of it. We can learn about who owned it, who wore it, all that kind of stuff. But the function of that thing, and then to expand that into the function of that particular belonging in a context that it wasn't really made for. But like in this exhibit, we're looking at these public events where people wore their regalia to meet the queen or to meet the governor general. And there were, at that moment, that piece of regalia is speaking very much politically, and it's saying, this is who we are, mm-hmm. This is our heritage, this is our ancient connection to this place, mm-hmm. and we have rights to this place, and we are standing up to, for those rights. And so the story of that robe becomes something much more expanded in a way that can only be told by people who are part of that history. But to be able to share that in a museum, like to expand people's view away from the object on the pedestal, you know, to think this is connected to real living people. Mm-hmm. And people today are connected to these things. These things are connected to territories. They have connections that extend outside the walls of the museum. Whether I'm working with historical collections, as we, like in the Great Hall, historical and contemporary works, but primarily historical, or in a special exhibit like this, that's always my primary goal, to show those connections. And those connections often challenge the way we, as museum visitors, see something. So we can have our own views expanded through the voices of people connected to these things. You know, these images of the Indian quotation marks that were so strong, and in those years were being really promoted through movies. So movies become more and more popular, and you have all those cowboy and Indian movies. So the stereotype is just strengthening. And at the same time, there's real First Nations people fighting for their rights. They don't even have the right to fight for their land claims. They don't even have the right to do their ceremonies or to wear their regalia in public. Like when you read the Indian Act and you read this legislation, it's beyond belief. Like without the permission of the Indian agent, you couldn't wear your robe out to an event outside your reserve and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Like it just floors you. And so you think people are dealing with those restrictions, mm-hmm. like major restrictions. Kids are at residential schools. All of that's happening at the same time as these big public events, Dominion Day and royal visits. And so all of these things are coming together. Very complicated, these questions of self-representation. Yeah. And so you focus in on certain things. But to bring together these amazing images of First Nations in public spaces representing themselves, this museum collection, and these contemporary voices will, I think, be a new experience for people and mm-hmm. help people to look differently at our shared history on this territory here.
I know that you had said that it was between 1900 and 1960-ish that you were looking at. So I guess what were some of the kind of key things that were going on at that time that caused you to look at that specific period of time?
Yeah. We could have chosen, gone more. We could have narrowed it down to like the 20s to 60s or something. We could have started in the 1850s and got to the present. You know, so we thought let's end around the mid 60s, because the mid 60s became a really kind of time of pivotal change in Canada. So there's much more recognition on a federal level of Indigenous political rights. There was much more public awareness of Indigenous issues and concern, human rights kind of issues, that sort of thing. We're coming to the fore in a quite different way. So we thought, let's stop around 65-ish, because otherwise we're into a whole other, you know, it's just such a big area, all the players in the game. Yeah. It's fascinating to read about the history, Indigenous histories, like in BC alone, in the late 1800s already, these delegations of chiefs who were going to visit, you know, government officials or royals or whatever to fight or to get to kind of petition for their land rights. And you read some of those petitions and you think, whoa, this sounds like now. Yeah. Hasn't changed that much, like these concerns about land rights. So there was a whole groundwork already before 1900 of very active First Nations leaders. And so in 1906, there was this really important event that happened, which was Chief Joe Capilano from Squamish Nation and Charlie Tsulpaimilt from Cowichan and Basil David from the Interior. They were selected by First Nations of the province to represent them and to go and visit the king in England. And so it's like my co-curator, Marcia Crosby, says, she said, that's huge. Like, if you imagine, like, the chutzpah of thinking, we're going to go and see the king and say we need to have our rights recognized to our lands. And then the effort in those days to travel, you know, you've got to travel right across the country. Then we found this phenomenal old photo in the Swedish Museum, Ethnography Museum, by Fluke. This fantastic photo, I don't think people have seen it here yet, of the two of the chiefs from here, and they're with some Huron chiefs. So they got together, they had to go to Quebec City because they had to take a boat from there to go to Liverpool. So while they're there, they convened with the Huron leaders, and I'm undoubtedly talking about land rights and strategies and what do they know, and you know, how can we learn from each other and all that kind of stuff, because communication and travel was so different in those days, but it was starting to modernize, so things are starting to become more. So those, you know, that, and then the trip to visit the king and getting all this press coverage in England, people were super excited to see these, you know, Indians from Canada kind of thing. And so they played that up, they used that, right, to become known. And then they did finally have an audience with the king and queen, and were assured that he would look after their land rights. Because everything goes back to way earlier, 1763, the Royal Proclamation, when the British, you know, royalty said, you colonizers can't negotiate with the indigenous peoples for the lands. We, the, you know, royal house, will do that. And that statement acknowledged indigenous land rights. So all land claims go back to the Royal Proclamation of 1763. And so that underlies everything we look at in this exhibit. The promise of the crown, it's always referred to, you know, from 1763, and it's still today. So you, any sort of land issues, it's the promise of the crown, because it was in British law that indigenous people have their rights to their lands. And so everything goes back. So you see these parades going through Vancouver, the Tunaha people coming from the Kootenays, marching through the streets of Vancouver as part of the Vancouver exhibitions, part of the precursor to the P&E. So it's kind of like this half entertainment, half politics. They took advantage of those things, and they're looking really serious, and they're basically saying, we are here. We have our rights, and we're standing up for our rights. Mm-hmm. And that's the underlying thing you see all through this exhibit, in all of these images, and the strongly expressed in the voices of the people whose audio you hear.
What does it mean to be looking at this archival footage and, like, documenting this history of resistance now, and not so much bringing in current acts of resistance into the exhibition?
Well, I think all of the audio commentators do that work. They find strength in this history, right? So these are the people who have, you know, the people we're looking at historically have all contributed to the foundation of what contemporary people are doing in their ongoing fight for their rights, right? So it's a continuum, and it's completely relevant because it's showing the long history of that work, that activist work. And it's feeding that activist work, right? Because it's showing, oh, look, like, we have been doing this for a long time, trying to make something better for the future, always thinking about the future. So that, I think that that's the relevance. It's not disconnected. It's, you know, vital still.
To use Gregory Cholette's words, borrowing from Guy Debord, Debord acknowledged that capitalism could appropriate even the most radical ideas and return them safely in the form of harmless ideologies. Perhaps begrudgingly, therefore, he understood the significant role that aesthetic processes play in establishing the centrality of desire in the everyday experience of workers under capitalism. To reject the spectacle would consequently require a method of freeing that which was held hostage by it, the imagination itself. I want to take two things out of this quote. One, the idea of returning the most radical anti-capitalist ideas as a form of harmless ideologies. And two, the idea of the spectacle that was essentially freeing of the imagination. The To Be Seen, To Be Heard exhibition at the MOA clearly shows the benefit of a spectacle in terms of activism, as well as the ingenuity that it takes to turn something on its head in an aesthetic sense, but actually as an act of rebellion. By doing what you have to and leaning into the stereotype to make that spectacle that frees the imagination from the chains of colonialism and capitalism. And on that note, I want to say a huge thank you to Karen Duffek and to Marianne Nicholson for meeting with me and having these interviews. It was a lovely time. And of course, to you for listening. Thank you so much for joining me for this first episode. There are 3 more exciting episodes to come, and I hope that you will listen to them. They'll all be aired here on CITR 101.9 FM, as well as on the CITR website. And with that, take care of yourself, take care of your community, and remember that looks can be deceiving.
What a lovely Vancouver summer night. I can't wait to sit by myself at the beach and look at my phone. Huh? What's that?
Man, what are you doing? Get over here and come jam.
Wow, what a lovely assortment of musicians. What are you guys doing?
This is E-Studio. We come together and build connections over music. No musical experience needed. Just come socialize and build your confidence playing music if that's your thing.
Wow, this is so awesome. Now I have a real-life connections with Vancouver's international community of musicians and creatives. Thank you, E-Studio. E-Studio is an international jam group where we celebrate music from all around the world and play together. Follow us on Instagram at estudio.cafe. estudio.cafe.
was lost, so if I.
It's where the clouds back in real time.
The sun goes up and goes down. Behind the trees and layered at sea, I cannot touch, but there's a world they tell me. Seasons, the water is so.
tropical breeze. In search of my crown, 3,000 meters above the ground. Everest don't freeze. Keep moving so you don't freeze.
Can't be calling you loyal if the first signs of trouble you running. Can't say that I know you if I ain't seen you at your worst. But we coming from nothing. Do my successes annoy you or just serve you as motivation? Is it pain when I enjoy or indulge? Fruits of my own labor. Diggins is grown player. If I can do it, you can too. Go get your own player. Cause ain't no place for the jealous and hating. We only out here celebrating each other. This black everydayish. All you need is the patience, determination. Cause the mountain is high. When you slip, it will test you. Have you doubt in the climb? Right when you about to arrive. Some take the easy way out, hitch a ride on the back of whoever is on the way up. They never show what they made of. They never put in the work. There's only so far I can take you. You got 2 feet so you can stand. I just hope you see the top just like we planned.
Rose-colored hue.